2020 is the beginning of the age of catastrophe. It's kind of the future warning us about what's on the cards for us. Because the grim truth that I think we're not facing is that our civilization is now beginning to collapse in very real and very serious ways.
Most Americans are comforted in the belief that their government and the country's best and brightest will step up to protect them.
The entire idea of American exceptionalism and the illusion of national security is that we are strong and that we can take a blow or that we'll protect Americans from some sort of major attack or some sort of cataclysm. But the truth is that we are very brittle right now.
We're always looking ahead to an America that never leaves anyone behind.
Just filming.
Oh my God.
But what if it turns out that the greatest threat in this age of catastrophe is that this idea that Americans will pull together in times of crisis is dead, killed by decades of treating American freedom as the freedom to get ahead at any cost?
During normal times, it's easy to think, the elite, the 1%, they're actually concerned about everybody's welfare. But then in that moment of crisis, when elites treat it as an opportunity for profiteering, rent-seeking, gouging from the public purse, that's the recipe for a failed state.
For over 70 years, our leaders have told us one thing under the bright lights.
The protection of the lives and property of Americans is the responsibility of all public officials.
I care. We're trying.
And it is my first duty as president to protect the American people.
We have it so well under control.
But America's shadow government has spent trillions of dollars on secret plans that serve one premise. When the shit really hits the fan, we're on our own.
I have nothing.
And while the government leaves us to fend for ourselves, the elite suck us dry to fund their own escape. Since the Cold War, the threat of nuclear annihilation was real. But the story that we're somehow all in this together was closer to a cartoon.
The best protection of all is the special shelter built according to specifications of your local civil defense organization.
Instead of protecting the American public by reducing the threat, the U.S. government sinks billions of taxpayer dollars into new and more sophisticated weapons of mass destruction. One of those was codenamed Starfish Prime. In 1962, American military scientists launched an experimental warhead from a remote island in the Pacific.
On Johnston Island, missile preparation for the July launch of the Starfish Prime shot was one aspect of an extensive team effort.
The experiment was designed to test the effects of nuclear explosions in outer space.
Equally important was the need to know the effects of high-altitude nuclear bursts on military command and control systems, which require long-range communications.
The explosion caused a massive electromagnetic pulse known as an EMP. The pulse fried electronics hundreds of miles away in Hawaii. It even blew out rows of streetlights in Honolulu. The Starfish Prime experiment exposes a frightening new possibility. What if something as simple as a basic infrastructure failure could deal a fatal blow to America? It's a scenario that has troubled doomsday planners ever since. Because it's a lot easier to imagine the lights going out in a mushroom cloud over New York City. And when the basic things we all take for granted suddenly stop working, in the end, that may be just as destructive to our way of life. 2020 has shown us that the boundaries between some distant future apocalypse and reality may be thinner than we'd like to believe. It has given us a preview of what things look like when our way of life starts to break down.
The fundamental basic institutions and structures of life that we took for granted have snapped apart like that.
What if the coronavirus is just a shot across the bow, a warning of what the future holds?
I think most people are very conflicted about this in the sense that we long for a return to normalcy, but there's also a part of us that says, you know, normal isn't coming back. This is it.
We've already seen how fragile our supply chains are thanks to the pandemic. We got a little preview of it through things like farmers having to harvest their crops or slaughter their livestock, but not being able to bring them to market, and so they just destroyed it because small elements in the logistics broke down. If there's a total breakdown, that's going to be a lot more frightening. You'll recall that at the start of the pandemic, there was a widespread toilet paper shortage. So multiply that, you know, minor inconvenience, and it probably cascades.
The government will tell you that when there's a disaster, you could be on your own for the first 72 hours. But if a cataclysmic disaster really happens, not everyone assumes that the government, or anyone for that matter, is really coming to help.
Rich people in government, they take care of themselves, but for the middle class and for lower income folks, you're absolutely on your own.
In the foothills of the Colorado Mountains is a secluded camp called Fortitude Ranch. It's run by Drew Miller, with a PhD in public policy from Harvard. He's a respected figure in what used to be considered a fringe movement.
We kind of had a phrase decades ago in the prep industry called 72 hours to animal, saying that, you know, for the first couple days, people will react okay, but eventually when there's no food, no water, and panic starts spreading, people are gonna get to their basic instincts of survival and it's gonna be laws. We don't believe that anymore. We believe it's more like 72 seconds or 72 minutes to animal. Chaos is going to break out within the first hour or hours.
A former Cold War military intelligence officer, Miller has inside knowledge that most people don't.
Government's number one priority is taking care of themselves. Police number one priority, continuity of government, taking care of the elected officials. No one is going to be responding to your call for help in your little house saying, hey, there's a marauding group coming through, breaking into houses, taking goods and stealing. So if you're a government official, you'll be taken care of, but the rest of us, we're pretty much on our own.
Back up!
We're prepared to defend ourselves. We don't just stockpile food, we have guns and ammo too, but a lot of the population does not, and they're gonna be victims, unfortunately, in that case.
The major weapons we recommend for our members are either an AR-15, which is not an assault rifle, it's a defensive rifle. People say, oh, you don't need this, this is just for the military. Well, in a collapse situation, if you've got a marauder group coming after you, and they got a lot of people, got a lot of weapons, you do need a lot of rounds.
In 2020, fear spread far and wide, beyond Fortitude Ranch. As the U.S. economy ground to a halt, and millions of Americans were put out of work, we witnessed how vulnerable our way of life really is.
I think people are scared shitless about two things. They're related. The first is the idea that we have built a technological society whose comforts we are reliant upon, whose coordination we need to sustain our current population, that if you just turned off all the machines tomorrow, that kind of handmade version of our society where all the crops were brought in by hand and so on would provoke mass die-offs. And the story we've been sold is part of the other fear, which is that our institutions are no longer trustworthy, that they have become not truth-seeking exercises, but rather auction houses in which people who are powerful and wealthy can buy a version of the truth that suits their parochial ends. In a world in which the Sacklers successfully convinced the FDA that opioids weren't dangerous and kickstarted an opioid epidemic that killed 200,000 Americans more than died in Vietnam, and where the Sacklers themselves became richer than the Rockefellers, how do you trust an institution?
Something like an EMP attack would wipe out not just the infrastructure that we have, but we would see very, very quickly the distance between the importance by which the government seeks their own survival and the survival of the American people. This idea of national security would collapse almost instantaneously.
But in the age of catastrophe, it doesn't really take an EMP to see what happens when the lights go out. And our basic institutions start to fail us. We all just lived through 2020.
So what happens when somebody now doesn't have a job, doesn't have the basic kind of access to resources that we take for granted in the rich world? You turn on the tap, water doesn't come out. You go to the store, and there's not enough food. You press the button, and there's no electricity. What happens? Well, history tells us when people grow suddenly poorer, what happens is massive waves of authoritarianism and fascism. History tells us that in absolutely unsparing terms. So that's the story of Weimar Germany becoming Nazi Germany. It's the story of Stalinist Russia. It's the story of the Islamic world. It's also the story of America today.
What if the doomsday scenario that politicians planned for since the Cold War turned out to be a lot less obvious than a nuclear bomb or EMP? What if it's our economy and the collapse has already begun? It's the first wave of a deadly pandemic. Most of America is under lockdown. The country's economy grinds to an almost complete halt. It's the worst economic drop-off in modern history. Borders are closed. Lines at food pantries stretch for miles in cities across America.
You're all set. Have a wonderful apocalypse.
It feels like this is what the beginning of doomsday and the apocalypse might feel like.
This is a government soup kitchen giving free meals to these men who were once skilled workers in a factory.
America has seen an economic collapse before. During the Great Depression, the nation was brought to its knees.
These people had come to depend on government relief. And where did this happen? Right here in these United States.
But during the Cold War, government planners imagined something even more catastrophic: nuclear war. Their plans involved almost nothing to ensure the survival of ordinary Americans, but they were concerned with what to do with those who somehow survived. And in order to put them back to work, they would need a way to pay them. Hidden under the Virginia mountains is one of the least known chapters of the Cold War. There, the Federal Reserve constructed its own mountain bunker, known as Mount Pony.
Walking down there is a series of hallways about as long as a football field. And they're cold, they're made of concrete, they're lit with fluorescent lights, and lining the hallways on both sides are these big steel reinforced doors.
On one floor of the Federal Reserve bunker, a massive steel blast door leading to a 22,500 square foot vault.
That's where they stored the billions of dollars of US currency.
It was one of the largest vaults in the world. It contained row after row of 9-foot-high stacks of cash. 700 million pieces of currency, much of it in the form of $2 bills.
This coincided in the 1970s with the period when the U.S. reintroduced the $2 bill, and Americans rejected it widely. So the Fed, rather than pulp the money, set it up in its own bunkers, assuming that after a nuclear attack, Americans would be less choosy about which currency they were using.
The plan was to stockpile enough cash to replenish the supply east of the Mississippi for 2 years. Long enough for the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to rebuild its presses. Smaller bunkers hidden in abandoned mines and under military bases were scattered around the country. But the government didn't stop with a plan on how to pay citizens to work. They also wanted a plan to take that money back. And so the engineers of the apocalypse turned to the IRS.
The joke is that there are only two constants in life, death and taxes. And so even in a nuclear attack, that held true. And if one didn't get you, the IRS wanted to make sure that the other did.
The IRS and the Treasury Department gave a lot of thought to figuring out how they could assess and raise taxes after a nuclear holocaust. Debating what happens to mortgages on homes that have been vaporized, or wondering how to assess the value of properties post-attack.
Part of what makes these plans so strange is realizing just how unworkable they would have been under almost any actual emergency.
While those impractical government plans are sitting on a shelf somewhere, when a real economic emergency actually arises, the government is left scrambling to find a way out. It's 2007, and America's wealthiest financial institutions have been getting rich by pushing loans and mortgages to people who can't afford them. Across America, roughly 3 million homes are foreclosed on, turning parts of cities into ghost towns.
The housing downturn and the surrounding uncertainty are significantly impacting our financial institutions and capital markets.
But the subprime mortgage crisis doesn't just hurt homeowners. The greed and irresponsible behavior of financial institutions has a ripple effect on the global economy, leading to the Great Recession in 2008. By the end of 2009, more than 15 million Americans are unemployed. Facing bankruptcy, the financial giants that caused the crisis are considered too big to fail.
Wall Street bet that the government would rescue them if they got into trouble. It appears that bet may be the one that pays off.
Without them, the economy faces a meltdown, and so the government steals a page from its nuclear playbook. The elite get saved. Only this time, it's not in bunkers under mountains of concrete. It's under mountains of cash.
And you can sit there and say, well, if they hadn't done that, the whole financial system would have melted down. But the fundamental problem was that they extended all of this support to the financial institutions, but didn't actually extend the same level of support to ordinary people.
While foreclosed homeowners are living in their cars, $45 billion taxpayer dollars get funneled to J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. Institutions that paid out $18 billion in bonuses to bankers and executives. Of a $475 billion bailout authorized by Congress, only 6% goes to help underwater homeowners. Most of the rest goes to banks and financial institutions. In the 2 years after the recession, the net wealth of most Americans shrinks, while the richest actually increase their wealth by almost 30%.
And that created not just a deep and lasting sense of economic pain for millions of ordinary people, but it also created this lasting sense of anger and unfairness and a feeling that basically the elites are going to get protected if something bad happens, but ordinary people aren't.
In 2007 and 8, the unmasking was quite shocking. What happened in the years just after that, where the bailouts were quite controversial, it appeared as the polluters got paid, the people underwater in mortgages did not get restructuring. The Tea Party was spawned on the right in America, Occupy on the left. And when inequality was exacerbated by the bailouts, the disintegration of credibility and faith spread like wildfire.
The Great Recession was only the beginning. While the economy gradually recovers, inequality in America worsens, and a new class of elite becomes even more powerful. In March 2020, Elon Musk laid off nearly 300 janitors and shuttle drivers due to COVID-19, sending his lowest earners home without pay. As these struggling workers joined soup lines and food pantries around the block, Tesla's stock price quickly rebounded the following month, and Musk's net worth soon more than tripled to over $90 billion.
Is this really worth it, Mr. Musk?
This is an uncomfortable truth about America today. It's not just that when the world is facing collapse, those at the top get the chance to survive. Today, they rise to even greater heights by getting even richer and more powerful. Nine years earlier, the streets of New York City erupt in protest. Since the Great Recession, inequality has only gotten worse. The wealth of elites has soared to new heights, while ordinary Americans continue to suffer. Poverty in America takes on new meaning.
Why should anybody in a rich country have to choose between their life savings and their life? Have to choose between their home and basic medicine? Have to choose between keeping the water and heating on or educating their kids?
Why can't I have a home? Why can't I afford my rent? I have five children.
These choices don't make sense. And they're the choices that everyday Americans make. These aren't the choices of like a small kind of underclass, right? These are the choices that the people formerly known as the American middle class have to make. So America is really a place of extremes. You know, you have trillion-dollar companies now in a historic first, Apple and Amazon, the world's first trillion-dollar companies. You have 50% of all new jobs in America are what they call low-income service jobs. It's a polite economist's way of saying people are becoming servants again. History is repeating itself. People are falling into peasantry and servitude.
Over the last four decades, the wealth of the richest Americans has continued to climb. But since the 1980s, the average working-age American has seen almost zero growth. Today, the top 1% in America earn more than 80 times the bottom 50%.
If I say that inequality in America is reaching third world levels, they don't believe me. And in some respect, they're right. But there are people who have to beg, who will never pay off their debts successfully. So there is not, maybe, perhaps yet, the level of absolute deprivation that there is in the third world. But the level of inequality has produced real degradation in America, real relative poverty.
Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, a record 40 million Americans have filed for unemployment. In July, an estimated 30 million reported not having enough to eat. That's one in every 10 households. Yet that same month, J.P. Morgan, the same financial institution that helped cause the 2008 recession and received billions of taxpayer dollars in bailouts, posts one of its best quarters ever. During the first weeks of the pandemic, as the unemployment rate in America nears 15%, the billionaire's wealth actually increases.
The American economy has been completely divorced from the fates of the people. This is a sad fact that we can see when unemployment numbers go up, but stocks rise. And the truth is that this notion that somehow or another the economy is somehow or another simpatico with the fates of the people is a complete fiction.
As people do poorly, the banks can still do well because more is being borrowed, more is being spent. The government printed $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion. The more they print, the better the balance sheet is for the lender. And that's the thing that matters. So you can end up with everybody poor and out of work, two-thirds, three-quarters of the people out of work, but the ones who've got that S&P 500 index fund, that's still going up.
Of course, we're seeing one industry after another being bailed out, but it is made more and more clear by the day that the fate of American people themselves is not being taken in consideration and is certainly not given the weight of taking care of businesses and corporations.
During a pandemic and the worst unemployment crisis in modern history, needy Americans scrape by on modest government handouts.
You have a job, you don't get health care. You don't have health care, you die. Barely anybody makes enough to pay off their debts or afford a decent standard of living. You have to care about yourself the most, and you barely have any money left over to care about anybody else.
These problems aren't invisible to the people who have the power to do something about them. Think about this. Amazon has 876,000 employees. If Jeff Bezos gave each employee a $100,000 bonus, he would still be richer than he was at the start of the pandemic.
If we taxed 60% of the windfall gains these billionaires made from March 18th until August 3rd, we could raise over $420 billion. That's enough revenue to pay all of the out-of-pocket healthcare expenses for every man, woman, and child in this country over the next 12 months. So that's the choice that we have to make.
Bernie Sanders gives voice to a popular movement of young Americans, an existential threat to the wealthiest people in the country.
It is morally obscene for billionaires to use a global pandemic as an opportunity to make outrageous profits and to very substantially increase their wealth.
What happens with elites is, when they're left to their own devices, they get greedier and greedier, and they get paranoid. They develop a fear of the slippery slope, that any infringement on their prerogative will lead to more and more and more, and pretty soon their heads will be in the guillotine.
It's 2017, just after Trump's inauguration. Media theorist Douglas Rushkoff shows up at an exclusive resort to deliver a talk about the digital future to a group of wealthy tech executives.
I was in the green room waiting to go on when five men came in to the green room and sat around this little table they had there. And I found out that there was no talk for me to go do, that these guys were the talk. And they didn't want to hear the whole thing I had prepared. They just started peppering me with these questions, like Bitcoin or Ethereum, which one should they bet on? Or augmented reality or virtual reality, which did I think would win? And then the third question, the one that made me realize that this was more than I signed up for, they said, Alaska or New Zealand? Meaning, where should they situate their bunkers for the event?
For years, New Zealand has been an apocalypse escape destination for America's elite. Notable home buyers include the tech tycoon Peter Thiel, an outspoken supporter of Donald Trump. He's also bet that America was not the place to be if things collapsed, so he arranged for a New Zealand passport just in case. Other American elites were getting similar ideas.
The rest of my hour with them was them asking me all these, like, really specific questions about how to water test their plans for the apocalypse, for the electromagnetic pulse, or the economic downturn, or the disease or war that would necessitate them leaving their Silicon Valley ranches and retreating to these fortified bunkers in the middle of nowhere.
The government's secret plans to save itself now have competition from the secret plans of the 1%. From converted Cold War bunkers and missile silos to specially outfitted yachts, a doomsday industry caters to the mega rich. Luxury bunkers with indoor pools, artificial sunlight, and supplies to stay sealed off from the world for years. From the Cold War till now, the most powerful people end up being the ones most afraid. And today, even as the actions of a few at the top have helped push poverty rates near their highest levels in half a century, it's the rich who fear losing control. Elite anxiety is on the rise.
The billionaires, they understand that they're playing a dangerous game, that they are running out of room to externalize the damage of the way their companies operate. Eventually, there's going to be, you know, the social unrest that leads to your undoing, which is why these same people are looking at creating bomb shelters, going to Australia or New Zealand.
What I would say is this was sort of an acceleration of the notion of what we had called gated communities, where you try to insulate yourself from the social discord that's outside. But here, it was an evacuation plan.
For the billionaires in the green room with Rushkoff, the biggest concern is protecting themselves from the unruly masses.
The question we ended up spending the majority of time on was, how do I maintain control of my security force after my money is worthless? So these guys had already secured Navy SEALs and security forces to come and guard their facilities for them. But if the US economy goes belly up, if the government's gone, if dollars are worthless, then why are those guys going to stay and protect them? Once they start talking in those terms, it's really easy to puncture a hole in their plan. So you've got 20 Navy SEALs hired to protect you and your family from the marauding mobs of people with Jeeps and bazookas. Let's say that they've got great weapons and great strategies. Why are they defending you? You know, why are they letting you be in charge? Why won't they want their commander to be the one in charge?
Clear, pop it.
Any monarch or ruler who is depending on their military to maintain their power ends up in a military coup, right? They end up taken over by their junta. It doesn't work that way. So what could we do? And there's like, so one of those, I was thinking, you know, we could do shock collars. You know, get them to wear shock collars so I could, you know, zap them if they're gonna go off and they understand that that's the price. Shock collars, really? You really think shock collars are gonna work? They're gonna wait till you're asleep in order to grab the little control button. It's just not gonna work.
Rushkoff offers a simple solution overlooked by the billionaires despite all their elaborate planning.
they were like saying, so what do we do? What do we do? And I said, well, if these guys are already working for you, like, pay for their kids' bat mitzvahs now. The idea was, if you're nice enough to your security people now, then they're going to be more reluctant to kill you. Because they'll think before they pull a trigger, oh, he paid for my daughter's bat mitzvah, right?
The arrogance of the American rich is staggering. It's so interesting when one gets to deal with them and you realize how ridiculous their ideas are. And they really think that they can play gilded survivalists when the society that they're ripping off collapses. And they can't.
Behind the thinking of the Cold War's doomsday planners is a strange mentality. It's okay to destroy the planet and kill nearly everyone on it. Because if you're one of the elite, you get to survive.
These crazy Cold War bunkers are like fantasy landscapes. They're kind of like monuments to elite delusion and paranoia, because they won't work, but they embody this self-justification. Yeah, sure, we can invest billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in atomic weapons and even use them, and civilization will survive. That's deranged thinking.
I'm going to lay the facts before you, the rough with the smooth. Some of these security facts are reassuring, others are not. They are sternly demanding.
The threat of global annihilation was at its peak during the Cold War. So was the belief that you could really survive an apocalypse.
These elites, with this kind of bunker mentality, which is inherited from the Cold War, it's kind of like gentrified from the middle class 50s, version of it, which was equally insane. The family of four will dive into a basement in the backyard, right?
The goal is adequate full-off shelter space for every man, woman, and child.
Probably many viewers cracked open their parents' or grandparents' bunkers at some point and found, oh, lo and behold, this is like, you know, flooded with 3 feet of stagnant water and, you know, these cans of beans are all corroded. You know, proving that this fantasy of living through an atomic war was just that, a fantasy.
When you're up in God knows where, you know, in the space station where Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk live, you don't have to worry anymore about the regular people. Or if you do, that's why you're building your space station, to get away from the civilization that you needed to rape and pillage in order to amass that level of wealth.
Coronavirus has widened the already enormous wealth gap in America. Radical inequality often leads to revolution. And as far as the 1% are concerned, the guillotines are coming.
We love to ignore the history and we love to pretend that we've progressed, you know, beyond the old challenges and that we're now hitting new material. We're not hitting new material. This is just class war all over again.
During normal times, the story we get from elites is that anyone can become rich if you just work hard enough, and anyone who's poor, it's basically their fault. Well, when suddenly everybody is suffering economically, that stuff goes out the window. It's ideologically destabilizing, and I think there's a possibility that people will start seeing through all these myths and start seeing the situation for what it is, which is a struggle between classes. Between the vast majority of people who work for a living and sell their labor and are dependent on a functional labor market, and this tiny, really, really powerful, really, really rich elite.
As the pandemic death toll surges, new waves of poverty spread around the world. The planet records its hottest month on record, and California burns. Elon Musk announces plans to colonize Mars.
What they were really looking at was, how do I earn enough money to insulate myself from the reality I'm creating by earning money in this way? You can't go it alone. The only possible solution is to make the world a place that you don't need to retreat from. It's such an easier, high probability strategy for success than the course that they're on, but they can't stop. They still think about technology as a way to insulate themselves from the real world. They want to insulate themselves from us because they know what they have to do to us to maintain the privilege that they're trying to live in, that privileged bubble. The most powerful people in the world, you know, they see themselves as utterly incapable of actually creating a future in which everything's going to be okay. Bet all their money on how do they, as individuals, somehow survive that disaster. They're destroying the whole thing. They're destroying the whole thing because they can't see a way out because of that paucity of imagination, because they don't want to acknowledge the larger operating system on which they're functioning. And they're slowly waking up to it, but rather than sort of come out of their mental bunkers and look at, wow, how could I operate in a less destructive, extractive way? Instead, they're just thinking, what's my safety plan? What's my escape hatch? How much food do I need to stick in my basement in order to survive the thing?
People who believe the disinformation, misinformation we've seen will do some pretty extreme things. If you actually believe the theories that are espoused by QAnon as reality, they would probably warrant some pretty dramatic responses.
Our president walked out there, went in front of the church, and held the Holy Bible in front of that American church.
Conspiracy theories can exist and thrive because the world is full of actual conspiracies.